Following success of last year's series, History Class, we organized a new series looking at novels and their relevance to the period of history in which they were written and published. All the classes will take place in here, and today's speaker is guest speaker Ray Gibbon, and the subject is, as advertised, Moby Dick by Herman Melville. He's going to speak for about half an hour, approximately, and after that we'll have more discussions in relation to the novel. Also, we'll have some teas and biscuits provided ready. Now, I'm going to hand to Sir Gibbon, and after that I'll make a second announcement about the next series of meetings in this place. So, I'm going to hand to Ray Gibbon.
Now, thank you very much, comrades, for the pleasure, actually, of coming here this afternoon to talk about Moby Dick. Not Melville so much, because if you can imagine, Melville, I suppose, is second after Shakespeare in the profundity and the vastness of the work that he did. So there's all sorts of other parts of Melville. There's Typee, there's Omoo, there's Bartleby the Scrivener, there's all of these. But with due respect, I think one could hardly have a talk on Shakespeare. One would have to have a talk on King Lear or Hamlet or something like this. So we'll keep it to Moby Dick, I think. Now, there's nothing like an audience of socialists, so you can, by and large, and presume that most of us have had some sort of an inkling of Moby Dick, whether it be by film or book, or we've tried it. Dare we say it's like some people, you know, have tried Karl Marx and not got all the way through it. However, we'll leave that as said. The reason I say, you know, before we go into this, first of all, I'd like to pay a kind of a tribute to somebody which maybe not all the comrades know, and he died a couple of years back, C.L.R. James. I mean, I knew him as Nello because, I tell you, as I say, it gives me a pleasure to go back about 1951. And he was very young at the time. Very, very young. I thought that Nello at the time was a Trotskyist, but of course it turns out he wasn't. He was all sorts of other things, but at the time he wasn't that. And I went along to a lecture in the Union Hall for the NMU, which is a very right-wing union, and Nello was giving a lecture on Melville and Moby Dick. Now, it's a long while ago, 51, that's why I say it gives me a lot of pleasure, because what it's doing at the moment is taking 50 years off of my life, because I'd like to kind of get over the enthusiasm that existed at that time. Perhaps it was because it was the end of the war, it was a time of hope, which, by Christ, I think we need today. But it was a time of hope. We thought we could do things, we thought we were going to change the world, and we felt confident about doing it. Now, of course, in the process, I realised that I was only about 20-odd years of age and I got a lot of things wrong. And I went up a few dark, strange alleyways and I participated in this 70-year march to nowhere for my sins. But I tell you what, to keep the faith, and I think if one does have an understanding of what Melville was trying to say at that period, it stays with you and gives you an understanding of the complexity of the world in which we live, and also the simplicity of the world in which we live. Right. Now, later on, I'm going by memory now, I happen to spend some time in Ellis Island as what in there, I suppose they like to call us internees. Basically, we were bloody prisoners, really. We weren't internees, we were prisoners, and for various reasons we transgressed the laws of the United States. And basically, there were, I suppose, there were over 1,000 of us there in the island at the time. And we were kept there, as I say, for transgressing various rules and regulations. And also, interesting point is, it wasn't an unenjoyable time. Bearing in mind we were all working clothes, most of us were seamen, and this was a time of relaxation and leisure. So we had time to sit around and talk, and there was no beer available, so you didn't have to go off and have a drink and forget about things. And we did, as young socialists would do in those days, we used to sit around and talk about usually the nitty-gritty of what was socialist literature then, which I would suppose we now know. People like Jack London, People of the Abyss, Dana, 2 years before the mast, Upton Sinclair, The Jungle. All of these things, because I think America at that time was very, very rich in what was called proletarian literature. And basically what it was saying to us, it was giving us an ambition, not as we understand ambition today, which was how to make a living and a price and everything, but a really great ambition to sort of change the world. Boy, what arrogance we had, eh? What arrogance. But anyway, nevertheless, we sat around and talked. And also, because we were young, we weren't encumbered with a great background of academic knowledge. We were discussing these things on the basis of our own knowledge, because we were working at the job. You know, the only way we ate is if we worked. And these things were, all of these authors were giving us a way out. And anyway, because I just listened to CLR, Nello, and even though the man's dead, what I'm saying is, he's speaking even now. It was given to me to talk about the guys all sitting around this vast hall in Ellis Island, all the, what Melville would call these meanest mariners, renegades and rebels. What a lovely phrase. And it made us feel good, because we were part of this history-making force, these meanest mariners, renegades and rebels. So we sat around and spoke. I would imagine that Melville, somehow or another, was deeper and has more to say to us today than the Upton Sinclairs and the Jack Londons, as good as they were. Sorry, I'll have to... because I'm going by memory a lot here. Now, one little thing here. I don't see my mate Roy is here, because I tried to get Roy to read Moby Dick for a long time. And because we live in a different world here in 1990, we have a few things which is, what's the word? Political correctness. As another new bright word, along with, you know, chuck out capitalism, call it market. We now have something called political correctness, which by and large tries to choke ourselves off from what we're supposed to think. And what Melville would say is, your mind is supposed to run free. Now, Roy has been a friend of mine for years, but he couldn't get past. He had this blockage on Melville because he got caught up in this business of killing whales, of all things, you see. You see how political it is. I mean, you can't discuss this because here you're going to kill a whale. We love whales. Therefore, we can't read a book. Now, of course, it's not a book about bloody whales at all. It's an allegory, you know. And one would imagine, you know, that it had its role in life, because at the very same time that these whales were being killed in an equal battle with a harpoon, three different men in a boat, at the same time, modern technology, which at that time hadn't occurred with whale killing, they were on the process of destroying the buffalo in America. Now, I would venture to suggest that had the Indian just killed those buffalo one by one for the sake of his clothes and the food and the chips which he used for his fire, those buffaloes would have lived forever. You wouldn't have had no problem about trying to save the buffalo. And of course, I would submit that at that particular period, at that particular time, you mustn't get bogged down in your love for the whale, because if three men in a boat were out there harpooning by hand a whale for food, the whale would have lived forever. There'd have been never any problem at all about whales. And I think we should understand this clearly, because as these problems come along in the world, the balance of the world, it's capitalism that upsets the balance. It's modern industry that upsets the balance, and we have to try and make this understanding of the world in which we live in. So we'll, you know, if you'll forgive me, and I wish Roy was here, because we, as mates, we spoke about this. And I just thought that I'd like to say that. Right. Now, also, there's another one. I didn't even realise this when I read the book, and I'm sure I can't read today. One of the most beautiful chapters in the book is Ishmael. You know the famous opening of this book, Call Me Ishmael. And he shares a bed with Queequeg, this, I suppose, call him a savage. But, I mean, he used to carry around a dried head. And his wonderful relationship that Ishmael had with Queequeg when they spent the night in the Spouter Inn before they went to join their ship in New Bedford. Now, Ishmael, being Ishmael, and being the type of person that Ishmael was, his personal relationship, his whole relationship that he dropped Queequeg as soon as, because the type of person, this needs to be understood, the type of person that Ishmael was, this fantastic relationship that he had with Queequeg was dropped because he had to sort out the problems of the world. And while that work was going on, there was Ishmael trying to see how many points, you know, the angel dancing on the end of a pin. So, that's another bit of the political correctness that I didn't notice until somebody said to me, started talking about, well, was Ishmael gay or was Queequeg gay? I'm sorry, it went right over my head. I didn't see this at all. All I saw was a beautiful relationship between two men. Right. Now, I suppose actually, when I said we've got to limit this discussion to Moby Dick, but I suppose we should say a few things about Melville, because he went to sea at the age of 20. Yes, the age of 20. And out of these experiences, just read through, out of these experiences he distilled the essence of Moby Dick, which came a long time after these other books that came beforehand. Omu, Typee, all these things were like a prelude to the maturity of Melville to write and make sense of the world in which he lived. Because if he'd merely written of his exotic experiences without probing the implications, he would have had a success in the 19th century, which he didn't have. He didn't have a success in the 19th century. They were very shocked at what Melville said. Didn't like him at all. So, but we gain, because if he'd have had a success in the 19th century, he wouldn't have had a success in the 20th. The success, maybe it's, what kind of, but it started in the 20s anyway. No doubt many thousands of young students got their doctorates on the basis of a delineation of Moby Dick and Melville. But I'm afraid that we have to give, and I've looked through lots of these dissertations, these academic dissertations, and they go into metaphysics, they go into, you know, he was looking for himself and all that. And I think that we must come down, or at least I must come down to the fact that it suited me, for more years than I care to remember. And I think basically what I want to try and get over the depth and the clarity of understanding that Melville had, if you can just get past any, because he wasn't a, get over this bookishness. I mean, we were lucky because we were involved in earning our living in the sea, so there was the entrance door. But if you can just get over this idea, it's rather like Shakespeare. You know, oh, Shakespeare. You know, we went to school and we studied him and everything. Here's Melville. It's quite a thick book. 350 bloody chapters, I say. But if you can get over the bookishness of it and get the feel of it, you feel that Melville knew what he was talking about in the years of his maturity. And the miracle of Herman Melville is this, that over 150 years ago, he painted a picture of our world in which we now live. It's unsurpassed. He saw what the future of the world was going to be. A newly industrialized world. So whatever Moby Dick is, whatever it is, it's no mere sea adventure story. He paints a picture of the world in which we live today. Now, Melville could be considered gloomy. D.H. Lawrence writes a lot about this. Oh, for God's sake, Herman, he says, shut up, going on, let's have a cup of tea. It's too much. But I would suggest today that as we're sitting around here, that we're living 150 years after Melville, and we do see problems. We listen to the radio, we watch the television if we do, we read the newspapers, and there are all these intractable problems which get more and more and more. And I go back to it, and I think we can say that there is an understanding there if we can tease it out. Right. Now, let's think. Who should we start off? We will start off with Ahab, Captain Ahab. Him with the one leg and the scarf up from the top to his bottom. Now, he was born in this is Ahab, not Melville. He was born in Nantucket at the period just prior to the Civil War in America. The new whaling industry, the new great whaling industry, which represented the growth of material progress. Ahab was a captain at 21 years of age. But the thing is about Ahab, you look at him and you see he's the captain of the ship. He had all the power that a captain has. You go away and maybe they're on a sea voyage for 4 years. But here we come to another thing. Because for many, many years, people would think that the revolt against the system under which we live, and that system is capitalism, would be easy. You would have workers and you'd have the dispossessed and everything like this. Some people turned around and said, well, okay, they'll make the attempt and it will fail. And we see that the attempt was made and it failed. But the thing is, it wasn't what Melville was saying. He tries to explain all those years ago, and it seems to me very clearly, that it gives you an understanding of what happened in 1917. Because they were Ahabs. To a man, they were Ahabs. Because Ahab himself, although he was the captain, he had anger and bitterness against the system, which kept him away from his family, because bear in mind, those whaling ship captains would spend 4 years away at home, and it was reckoned that some of them they would spend 40 years at sea and spend 3 years at home. 40 years at sea and 3 years at home. No female companionship, none of the nurturing that they get from that, just 3 years. There was no wife, no kids, no nothing. So he harbored such a deep resentment against the system in which he lived that he had his own reasons for changing it. It wasn't only that working people were driven down, and I think this is very crucial, because it wasn't only the workers that were, as we know, I'm one of them, but it took a reading of Melville to understand that Ahab himself bore such a resentment against the world in which he lived. After all, the whale had taken his leg off him as well. He only had the one stump of a leg. Right. So, now, and incidentally, you know, a captain on a ship, you work hard on a ship, you know, and you get promoted. You get a bit more money and everything like that. Until you become a captain, and a captain doesn't have to work. The only role of the captain on the ship is to take the blame if the bloody thing sinks. That's all a captain has to do. I know it might sound kind of crazy, but a captain literally, according to articles which he signs, you say you have to work, but he doesn't have to work. But Ahab, you see, was a representative of a type of a new type of person that I think that we can see with hindsight that not only the meanest mariner and rebel has resentments against the system, that there are other types that have resentments against the system and they are to be wary of, and we know to our cost that they are to be wary of. We see them in our politicians. They hold resentments against the system. They know that private capital doesn't want to purchase their labour. They have a million resentments, so they want to change society and change it for their benefit, not our benefit, the people that do the work. And I think that is a very clue to the understanding of the past, as I said, the 70-year march to nowhere. And incidentally, I participated in that bloody march. And there was less excuse for me than others. I don't know if I was part of the crew or I was a bloody Ishmael. But certainly, we pay for our errors. And getting tired feet and tired mind and tired everything else, we made mistakes. I'm talking about me because I know that some of you didn't make a mistake. I was, you know, what the hell, I've got nothing to lose. If you make a mistake, you make a mistake. And if there's any younger people here, it would, to understand that there are other sorts of people that want to change society for their own benefit, and then they proceed to run society for their own benefit. And as we've seen, that's happened. Now, we've got Captain Ahab. If we understand in our mind this character, he was a master of his craft, a master of the art, he was a wonderful seaman, he was devoted to his work, he embraced America's gospel of work, but it all turned to dust and ashes in his mouth. So he became obsessed with the killing of the whale. This wasn't just a whale that he was killing. He was killing the own hobgoblin in his mind. Now, you know, I don't usually like giving quotes because they are difficult to take them out of such a vast book. But, you know, talking about on a ship, you know, the captain and the mates, first mate, chief mate, second mate, they used to eat all alone in the cabin. And it gives you an idea of resentment that get built up. And Ahab says, and I'll read this quote, "In the cabin was no companionship socially. Ahab was inaccessible. Though nominally included in the census of Christendom, he was still an alien to it. Even Ahab couldn't stand it. "He feels like going down to one's tomb," he would mutter. Now, the reason he said this is rather a strange thing on sailing ships in those days. The captain would eat, and the mates would come in order, first mate, chief mate, second mate, and they would leave in reverse order. And one of the complaints of the third mate was that ever since he'd been promoted from being a harpooner, he was bloody well starving, because he was last into the bloody cabin and first out. And he was seriously thinking about going back to being a harpooner, because ever since he'd been promoted, he couldn't eat. So you can quite see why Ahab couldn't stand it. But we move over to the harpooners. In their cabin, that was much different. They were all there. They were working. They weren't chasing a white whale. They were enjoying their food. There were pleasures. There were everything. Now, incidentally, you know, in the process, to underline this again about resentment against the system, would Ahab live today? I'm afraid they'd lock him up. The owners would lock him up, because let's face it, when the whaling ship took to sea, there were owners back in Nantucket, good Quaker owners. They wanted their percentage. That was the role of a whaling ship, was to catch whales, bring them back home, sell the bloody oil so that we can live in our nice houses. Huh? But Ahab, who incidentally didn't show up, and this business about not working, didn't show up for a week until the ship was at sea a week, and he comes up with this wonderful program that he says to his crew and the mates. He said, "Well, I'm going to tell you." He said, "We're not here to hunt whales, we're here to hunt one whale, Moby Dick." Now, Stump would turn around and say, "My God, my captain," he said, "I will go to the ends of the earth, but I'm here to hunt whales. I've got to get my lay, my share, my percentage." But you see, again, the understanding that Ahab had such command of the language. He understood his crew, because he'd been a captain, he'd been a seaman for 40 years. He filled them all up with this desire to catch the white whale. Now, it was palpably crazy. They were all there to earn wages, to catch whales, not one whale. But we know, don't we know the type? We've seen, and we see the Saddam Husseins of the world. We see the Khomeinis, we see the Ceausescus, we see them all, ourselves. Don't worry about what's happening. Use the language, use the words, use the silvery tongue to get us all in this merry trip. After all, didn't we see, I imagine the bloody, what's their names, the Stalins, the Lenins, whoever they were. Come on, we've got this role that we have to fulfill in the world. And meanwhile, people look and say, "Well, I'd like to eat now again." But this was Ahab's, this was what Melville understood 150 years ago, that there were people that could do this, to get people involved in this urge, the enjoyment of the trip. Of course, mind you, now and again he had to bribe them. And then what Melville, there's a famous one where he pins a doubloon on the mast with a bloody great hammer. This was a little bit above, because besides the joy of the chase to work out Melville's future, Ahab's future, there's a doubloon for the first man that sights the whale. It's there, so the paper. Incidentally, none of the crew ever got it, because Ahab was the first one to sight it. He pulled it down. We know about that too, don't we? We know about it too, because we live. I don't know, sticking my neck out. Going back talking about all these things reminds me that we live in a world whereby we have a political class of people that's doing this every day of the week. They try and gee people up and go off on this and go off on that. And it's like a bad record going around and round and round. And the problem that I think that we have today is that we're in a sort of a historical process, people have seen through this, that when I was younger, as I mentioned, this hope business, we actually thought we could change the world, and we did it, we did, you know, this, that, and the other. And the world now, they seem to have split off part of this world in which we live, that politics becomes a sort of a paid occupation. You have a political class, the Ahabs. They've gone on from Ahab, they've actually created a political class of people that are allowed to discuss what's going on in the world. All of the problems, you know, whether it's violence or whatever it is. And I don't have to tell you about all these problems. And I think that that's what we have to do, is to understand that this word politics is not the private property of this political class, it's our property. And we are the ones that's going to change the thing. And if we leave it up to the Ahabs of the world, and it'll come again. They're all there, the Ahabs aren't died. They're not dead. You look over in Romania or Poland or Czechoslovakia, they still want their pound of flesh, to mix the metaphor. They're still there, they haven't died. The Ahabs of the world still exist, and their mates, the chief mate, the second mate, and the third mate, they still exist. Because maybe we should talk a bit about these mates. Right? There was Starbuck, the chief mate. And all of these names, incidentally, when you read, I went one time to Nantucket, and all these names still exist. They're good Quaker names in Nantucket. Now, Starbuck was a Quaker, as most of them were, a good, responsible man of reason. Favourite word of Melville's, intrepidity. Intrepidity. He loved this word. Almost seems like every second page he's got it. But he was a dependable man. But at bottom, Starbuck was an afraid man. He was afraid. Then there was a second mate, Stubb. Fearless Stubb. Fearless as fire. Jolly. Reckless. He was also afraid. Then there was the other mate, Flask. He was stubborn, obstinate. He had no imagination. One wondered why he would be a mate. So there you have him. A maniac captain and his three mates. Splendid seamen, admirable whalemen, first class at their jobs, a murderer, sailing off into the world. Right. Then we have the three harpooners, which they were the creme de la creme of a whaling ship. And bearing in mind that we live today, you know, in a world which is suffused with racism, suffused with nationalism. And I was just talking on the phone, and I thought, isn't this strange why Roy should be saying this to me about nationalism, because he was worried about it. And I imagine we all are. But then again, the political organisation of modern Europe has been based upon the creation and consolidation of national states, no? Every single national state had, and still has, also a racial doctrine, because racial comes with national. National race, national stock, national blood. Each one says is superior to all the other national races, stocks and bloods. And that's where we are today. I think so. And I think this is one of the biggest... Maybe humanity has to go through these understandings. But I do think that our people of the world are... At the moment, at this historical moment in time, we have to grapple with this. These nationalisms, where they come from, why do they exist? And again, as I say, I think Melville can help us out on this too. Because you see, the crew, let's skip the harpooners at the moment. Because the harpooners are partially of the crew and part not, but accepted by the crew. The chief thing about the crew, though, and Melville, and they tried to, at the time, tried to censor this out of the book when you wrote it. Tried to censor it. But bear in mind that Melville was part, when he went to sea, was part of the crew. And the chief thing about the crew is that they work. They're not suffering workers. And in 1860, they weren't revolutionary workers. Nor people who must be organised. Nor people that must have more leisure or more education so that they could know what to do with their leisure. All of these things which we get mixed up with today. What mattered to those workers, and in fact to all people, I would say, not just workers, to all people, what matters to them is the work they do every day. So many hours a day, nearly every day of their life. And that's the crucial problem. And that's what needs to be understood. Because it's people and workers that create the wealth that the Ahabs resent and the owners, the capitalists, use to their advantage. And it when you read the story, it runs like a thread through it. The love that Melville and the hope that he put into those workers. For the crew are the real heroes of the tunnel. The real heroes. Now, I mentioned about the three mates. Incidentally, when it was coming towards the end of the ship, one of these mates was the only one that Ahab could depend upon. He'd given up on the crew. They were fed up with going after this whale. I mean, this one of the most wonderful chapters in literature is the last 3 days of the chase, chasing this whale. They'd given up. They didn't want to know sod all about the whale. They wanted to get home safely. They'd listened to this story about pie in the sky. They wanted to get home. So he couldn't trust anyone. When he went up aloft, he couldn't even trust them to sight the whale. So when he got up to the top there, climbed up to Gallant, could only trust one man. That was Stubb, his chief mate, so he could hold the rope. And of course Stubb, we know the representative of the Stubbs today. We know the prototypes of the Stubbs that will say things for a year, buy it all, and then they will change their minds when the line changes. And you will look at this, and you will hardly believe it, but they're quite happy. They're the Stubbs of the world. They're quite happy, they can change their line because they're following now their Ahab. So, I think we have a clear understanding of who the prototypes of the Stubbs of the world are in our present society. Right. Let's say, I'm trying to give you a little example. There are two wonderful chapters in the book. He wasn't an evil man, Stubb. He goes in once and the captain says, sod off, otherwise I'll kick you out the cabin. Now, Stubb, he knew his job. He said, I resent this captain kicking me out, you know. The prototype stuff. So he goes out and eventually he has a dream. This is a wonderful dream he has. He dreams that first of all about being kicked by a human leg isn't as bad as being kicked by his ivory leg. And then he has another dream. And so he gradually works it out in his mind, in his brain, in his dream, that in fact it's an honour to be kicked by a real leg. And we know them, we see them on our television, we listen to them on radio, and we sometimes wonder, is this a mad ship that we live in? I mean, I'm sure that we must think, you go round and round in circles. Anyway, so that was Stubb. But Ahab also, now bearing in mind again, he wrote this book 150 years ago, and he's talking about today. And this wonderful conception of a study of the world that he was living in, you see. Also, he had, like most dictators. He had a Praetorian guard on board ship. Because you can't always rely on your mate, your teammate, or, you know, this, that, and the other person. You have to have this special Praetorian guard. And there's another wonderful part of the book, Fedala. I don't want to insult Malayans, but they were all Malayans, you see, and in those days Malayans were considered to be a particular type of person that you could rely upon. So he, Fedala, had his Praetorian guard, which was like, what's the modern word for Praetorian guard? Like a secret police. Incidentally, Fedala dies like all secret policemen die when things move. But anyway, that's Fedala. He actually dies just before Ahab. Right, I don't want to go on too long. Now, so there, what do we... There are so many wonderful chapters in the book. And it's so difficult, actually, to isolate a few. But basically, what we'd say is that the Pequod, which was the name of the ship, the Pequod, at that time, represented the ultimate progress of the world. It was a factory, because when they caught the whales, they turned it into blubber. It was a factory ship, a hunting ship, and everything. And all of the technology, all of the knowledge of that period went into this ship, the Pequod, you see. So the Pequod of 30 men can come to represent the world. Just 30 men on that ship. They came from everywhere under the sun. And the incident, the interesting thing was that the only white man on the ship was the narrator, Ishmael, who was this footloose fella. These very dangerous people that want to get involved in working class politics and going to show them the way out. He was a white man. The three mates were white men, and Ahab was a white man, but everybody else, all the other 27, they came from Africa, they came from Malaya, all the islands, a wonderful word that Melville calls isolatos, all different islands of the world where they came from. And they, in other words, federated along one keel. Now, they're there, their nationalisms. They all come from different parts of the world, but they were federated along the keel of this ship so that they got on because they worked. And they had no... They could accept their differences and they could embrace their likenesses so that they all got along. Because, you know, at one time it was reckoned that when the American railroads were built and the whaling was going on and all of these sorts of things, not one in two of the men involved were Americans, were white men. They were everywhere under the sun. They were Chinese people, you name it, they were there. So, there's the Pequod. There they are, federated on this same keel, living together in perfect harmony. But here we have a problem. The whale is their fate. The Pequod is the world. And the mates, at any point in time, could have saved the ship from utter destruction. Because bear in mind, the whole damn ship sunk. The lot. There's a famous thing at the end where it says, oh my God, the ship. And they all drowned, all dead, except Ishmael. Give him license. Ishmael had to survive to tell the tale. But there were a couple of points there where the mates, and we know who the mates are, we know who we're talking about now, we know who the Ahabs of the world in which we live are now. We see them, we recognise them, we work with them, we listen to them on television, we hear them on the radio, we read their articles in the bourgeois press, so we know who they are. The point is, now we know. Maybe they didn't know in Melbourne's time, but now we know. We recognise them for what they are. There's a few chapters there. Starbuck had a gun on him one time. Had a gun on Ahab. He was so angry at Ahab. Puts down the gun because he's afraid of the authority. And the famous line, and maybe sort of taking it out of context sometimes, oh, captain, my captain. He's enthralled to him. So that any time those mates could have saved that ship, or they could have saved the world. The ship, the world, they could save it from destruction. Ahab was already a broken man because it's coming up to the thing. He, by the way, lost one of his legs and he'd had to grovel to a carpenter to make him another leg out of a whalebone. Right, so they could have saved him. Now we have a problem. Because not only the mates were on the ship, not only was the Praetorian Guard in the shape of Fadala, but there was also the crew. And what were the crew doing?
The mates,
I'm sorry, darling. I'm sorry. Mates, when I say mates, it's a merchant seaman's expression for officers. I'm awfully sorry. No, you're quite right, dear. It's rather interesting because I was talking to a friend, the other day, and I was talking about jumping ship. And he literally thought that you jumped off a ship. No, it's understandable. Why should he know about jumping ship? Yeah? I mean, he had a picture in your mind, you're just some kind of a nut. You jump off a ship. You don't jump. What you do is, when the ship goes, you're not so stupid as to jump off the ship. When the ship departs, and you, actually, you're breaking the law, incidentally, you're not allowed to jump ship. Jump ship means you just stay where you are and you let the ship go on. And you stay where you are. Usually it's in a better country than the one you've left. When you boil it all down, there's usually an economic reason for jumping ship. I've never heard of anybody that jumped ship that it wasn't for an economic reason. It's usually because this place is better than the one you left. Right. And as I say, please don't apologise, because I was in the Merchant Navy for about 3 years before I knew that the minute that a ship sunk, your wages ceased. And do you know, I only learned this in about 1948, that during the war, in early 1942, now how long had the war been on? From 1942, the war started in 1939, all these wonderful heroes that we read, they make all these wonderful rank movies about the people starving in the ships and looking at their mate and wondering if he's fat enough to eat. You know. So they all... But it was only in 1942 that they decided that your pay could continue after the ship sunk. So could you imagine a fellow, if the ship sunk at 12:05 and the captain was nice to you, he'd pay you to 12:15. But from then on, you're on your own. And honestly, you say this question about mates, I didn't know that, and I'd been on the bloody boats for 3 years without knowing that the fellas, when they'd had their ship sunk from under them, your pay stopped. There you go. Boy, was that some problems. Yeah, say that again. And incidentally, sorry, did I digress slightly? I also learned another expression. We've all heard about barrack room lawyers and sea lawyers, we used to call them. Basically, all that a sea lawyer was a fellow in the crew that gave the mate, your friends, information that the officers objected to. And they tried to demonise him. And for a long time, I was in a mix-up about this, because being called a sea lawyer was a sort of, like a term of abuse. As only as you get older, you realise that it's a term of approbation to be a sea lawyer, because you were an unpaid lawyer for your friends, different to the officers, or the union. It was in the pay of the officers, in the pay of the union. Oh, I could talk to you for hours about the famous National Union of Seamen. Havelock, something or other, whatever his name was. Havelock, they used to call him. Not Havelock, Havelot, because he had the lot. Right. So therefore, we're left with a crew. And I think it's an important question. when he said what could be done and who could save the ship, and the crew could have saved the ship, quite right. But I think, you know, to talk about it, you're talking about the crew, what the crew can do now, you know, it's like you're talking about the position of the crew 150 years ago. And had the crew, in fact, crews did mutiny. There's a chapter in Melville there where a crew does mutiny. And they mutinied, and they went back home, and nothing happened, actually, because incidentally they could have mutinied against Ahab, because he'd broken all the articles himself. But in 1860, they didn't know what we know now. And nothing would have changed had the crew mutinied then. Nothing would have changed. Everything would have gone back to square one. And that's the problem that we have. But today we know. We have no excuse. And there we have it. We can't say today that the crew are too busy rowing. If there's only us to do it, then we have to say it. We have to keep on saying it, because the problems are mounting as every day goes by. Never, I think, since 1904, whatever the year was, has it been more essential. And isn't it interesting, the more essential that socialism becomes, the more necessary, the more that it, the deeper this system goes into the crisis, the more necessary it is. It's almost as though, if you listen to the radio today, it's like the word doesn't exist. And this is what we have to fight for, because history is on our side. Thank you very much, Conway.